The Ultimate Predator Podcast is supported by the good folks at Venator Media Solutions. They're a multimedia company focused on hunting in the outdoor community. Whether you need a new logo for your brand, clever ad campaign to set your company apart, or an editor to tidy up your writing, these guys are among the best in the business, and they're hunters and outdoorsmen themselves, so they get it. Venator Media Solutions. Amplify your adventure.
Welcome to episode 2 of the Ultimate Predator Podcast. My name's Nate Granzo, I'm TUP's editor-in-chief, and I'm here with my longtime buddy, the founder of the Ultimate Predator, the Simon to my Garfunkel, Murtaugh to my Riggs, the Aykroyd to my Belushi, Mr. Carl Hiley. How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing great, man. How are you?
I'm good. I think we're going to have a lot of fun today. We've written quite a few articles that I think we can focus on, have an interesting conversation about a few key topics. Now, the first one today, I think we should talk about the Taylor knockout factor, that article that I wrote. Mm-hmm. It's still being used today. It's kind of this weird metric that gets thrown around, and I just thought we should take a hard look at how that came to be, who this guy was that came up with it in the first place, and whether it has any legitimacy whatsoever.
Yeah.
Another one is my most miserable hunting experience, and I want to hear yours. And you weren't very forthcoming with that. You didn't want to share that with me out of the gate. So this will be new for me too. I've hunted with you for a number of years, but I don't know what your worst experience was.
Yeah, it doesn't involve you. Surprising.
I don't believe you. That's surprising. And then I think we should also have our dumb idea poorly executed. Still working through the name on that. I don't know if you guys have any suggestions on that. I think, you know, something like Ultimate Screw-Ups might be a good one. We can kick the idea around a little bit. For now...
Right into us. Let us know what you think.
Absolutely. For now, it's dipe time. Dumb idea poorly executed. I think that's what we should call it for now. And we're going to talk about the elk behavioral study that was conducted by the Idaho Fish and Game Commission. It's a commission, right?
We'll just say Idaho Fish and Game.
Fish and Game. But the article that you'd written about that and how they sort of stumbled through this whole behavioral study and how they potentially could have done things a little bit better.
Yeah.
In our opinion.
In a lot of people's opinion.
Clearly that was shared by a number of people. So we're not alone in our views on that. But let's start with the Taylor knockout factor.
Yeah, tell us about it. Give us the lowdown on the Taylor knockout factor.
First off, the guy is... or was a big game hunter, John Pondero Taylor.
Yeah.
He is a big game hunter. He was a poacher, lover of very large guns. This guy was a big proponent of some of the really old world calibers. Like back, this was in kind of a transition period where around the turn of the 20th century, so we're talking like early 1900s when modern propellants were coming on the scene, new calibers were starting to be seen, and we started to see it totally different behavior of modern ammunition because they had not only modern propellants, but bullet technology was kind of catching up. And there was this transition period where a lot of these big game hunters from the 1800s who had kind of made their way with these big black powder cartridges, which have black powder has kind of a finite amount of potency to it. Like you can cram volume-wise, you can cram a whole bunch of black powder into a cartridge, but you're really going to cap out at a certain velocity. Mm-hmm. So they made up for that by having these really big diameter, heavy bullets that were moving at a slower velocity to kind of make up for that. And over time, we've shifted and we've seen now that smaller calibers can deliver they're perfectly adequate and very deadly with modern bullet technology, modern accelerant or propellant. But John Pondero Taylor was not of that mindset. He was still kind of in that historically big caliber. He was a big proponent of that. And there's no knocking the guy. This guy hunted, at least according to his records, he had hunted for 25 years, 10 months out of the year. I mean, the guy was a major big game hunter, hunted pretty much everything in Africa. So there's no question that he had a lot of in the field experience.
Yeah.
But he came up with this metric to kind of codify the knockout power. I won't say killing power because he explicitly said that wasn't what this was, which is good. I think that's at least, you know, he had some sense of self-awareness.
Sure.
The notion of killing power, and we've seen this in the field, there is no way to codify that because what works one time may not have the same effect. A lot of it's shot placement.
Yeah.
Conditions have a huge impact. The bullet, you know, if it hits a bone and deflects, it could do something completely different. I've seen deer that have been hit with a 300 Win Mag and have had vitals blown out where they shouldn't be able to, it should have been done. Right. I mean, right there. And they've run for 150 yards.
Yeah.
So there's no way to really predict, you know, killing potency. But
yeah, this. Also, like, that deer ran 150 yards, but it still died.
Oh, it did.
So, right, like, right. What is killing power, really? It killed it.
Right. Yeah, it exactly. It delivered exactly what it was supposed to, but it's just every shot is different. All the conditions are different. So, whenever I hear, you know, the knockdown power of a caliber or the killing power, it's like, that's not really a thing.
Right.
And ballistics, I should have prefaced this whole thing. Ballistics is one of those, you want to talk about going down a rabbit hole. It is a quagmire, and everybody is so deeply entrenched in their own perspectives and their own views on the perfect caliber, the ones that are better than others, the old 9mm versus 45 caliber debate that's raged forever, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So this is one of those hot-button topics where everybody seems to think they've got it figured out, and almost no one does.
Right.
Well, John Taylor was one of those people who thought he had it figured out. And I would argue that he probably didn't have it quite as figured out as he made it out to be.
Yeah. So give me the lowdown on what is the actual
I buried the lead,
knockout factor? Like, what's this equation, knockout factor? How's it work?
Yeah, the knockout factor, which it was, he named it the Taylor knockout factor, which was, you know, very humble of him to name it after himself. It's a pretty simple formula. The idea was you multiply the bullet weight in grains by the bullet velocity in feet per second, by the bullet diameter in inches, and then you divide that result by 7,000, which is the number of grains in a pound. On the face of it, it sort of looks like it could make sense. You know, they're all kind of crucial aspects, I guess, of a bullet, or, you know, the velocity is important. But if you look at it mathematically, it kind of overlooks a number of things that are pretty key, and it does tend to favor, just by the very nature of this equation, it favors big diameter, heavy, slow-moving bullets, which plays right into what John Taylor was interested in, what he was a proponent of. A perfect example, you look at like a 30-06, I think I mentioned this in the article, a 30-06 on his scale. A 110 grain round that's moving at 3,400 feet per second would score a 16 on the Taylor knockout factor scale. A 35 Whelen, which is kind of one of my favorite calibers, as you know, is it's a necked up 30-06. So it's really very similar. The cartridge itself is not dissimilar from the 30-06. It just accepts a bigger bullet, a 35 caliber instead of a 30. That ranks a substantially higher 27 on the scale. And I think the scale only goes like 60 or 70 with the top end being these gigantic, unrealistic, you know, the really mammoth rounds that were used for elephant hunting.
Right.
So as far as the scale goes, for a 30-06 to score that much lower than a 35 Whelen, it's basically the same cartridge. Yep. The only difference is that the 35 has a bigger bullet and it's moving slower,
right,
but it still scores so much higher. So, I mean, it clearly tilts in favor of bigger bullets, slower moving bullets. And I don't know that that's particularly accurate.
Yeah, but, you know, I think this was like back before ballistics learned about things like, you know, secondary fissure and
cavitation.
Yeah, exactly.
And even sectional density and, you know, the composition of bullets has changed so much. Even in the last, you know, few decades, they've come up with a number of different designs that are a lot more effective, and they behave differently upon impact, that kind of thing. So that, but none of that factors in to his knockout factor.
Right.
And I should go back again. I should have led with this. The knockout factor, the reason he called it that, and he spoke to this in one of his books, was it wasn't meant to codify killing power or necessarily even the potency of a round. His metric was actually knocking out an elephant, with the premise being an elephant has a very small brain for the size of its head.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very small target. And if you miss that target, if you miss the brain itself, the impact from the round hitting the skull will actually knock out an elephant. And he said this knockout potency of a round, he said, well, a larger round will knock it out for longer than if... So the basis is that you miss, right? It's not like anything when placed on the brain would do the job. But the whole premise of this equation that he came up with is based exclusively on this like notion of knocking out an animal and how long they stay unconscious based on the caliber, which is kind of a strange thing to try to codify. But
yeah. Now, I wonder, did you look at how these numbers would compare with just like a regular kinetic energy equation for these different calibers?
I haven't, no.
Because I wonder, I mean, it would seem to me that just the, however much kinetic energy you deliver to the elephant would kind of have an impact on how, right? Just like if somebody punched you in the face,
right?
The harder somebody punches you in the face, the longer you're going to get knocked out for.
Right.
So I wonder if it's just kind of the same sort of thing, and he just came up with his own formula to make special numbers that make him feel good.
Right. And they could track perfectly with the kinetic energy. Like that, that might, I don't know, in a way, I guess that would kind of lend some validity to it.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's in that case, it would strictly be just him making his own proprietary metric, the scale. But he just, reading about it was kind of hysterical to me because this guy comes out right away saying, I'm not calling this killing power. I'm saying this is strictly for this very narrow definition of the knockout power. Okay, fine. But then he walks it back and says, well, but it's a way better metric than, you know, those who look at velocity as being all that important, because it's not.
Right.
He dismisses velocity and says, you know, big rounds are where it's at. And then he walks it back again. And he says, well, I don't have any basis in mathematics. I'm not that kind of guy. I don't pretend to have the knowledge to back this up mathematically, but I have a lot of field experience. And what can I say? This equation just works really well.
Yeah.
And it brings me back to high school math, where I was guilty of that, where I'd say, hey, I got the answer. Yeah, it's the right answer, but you didn't show any of your work.
Right.
And you can't explain why it's the right answer, so you're kind of missing the point.
Yeah.
That's him. He can't, and he admits it. He has no foundation of math to back up any of this, physics, any of that. It's just strictly from his observations. And it's such a narrow definition, I guess. That's the part that gets me, is like this idea that it's not really speaking to the effectiveness of a round. It's strictly how long an animal would be knocked out from a miss, which seems like, how often does that happen?
You know, I mean, it's around, and people talk about
but
it.
But that's just it. And when I came across this for the first time, because I hadn't even heard of the Taylor knockout factor until I started looking around at bear guns, you know, bear handguns.
Yeah. I was gonna ask you about this, but I wanted to finish up on the actual thing. So
yep. I was looking at the 480 Ruger, which I'm intrigued by it.
Now hold on. Before we get to this, what's the lowdown on it? Is it the Taylor knockout factor? Is it like a useful metric? Is it not?
I don't.
Right. I mean, you're like,
right. No, that's,
or is it BS? Right.
Right.
In your art. So what do you where do you come down on that?
Speaking to what he intended it for, I think it probably holds some legitimacy. I'm not going to say a lot, but I'm not going to discount the fact that the guy spent an awful lot of time in the field.
Yeah.
Shot quite a lot of animals with a number of different calibers. I mean, he knew a lot, but it was all just kind of this observed knowledge.
Yeah. Well, and it's hard for us to speak to because neither of us has shot an elephant.
And And today, very few hunters are still alive that even if they had shot one elephant, have they shot enough to be able to start drawing conclusions about a number of different calibers, for instance? It was just such a different time that I don't know that there aren't a number of ways to contradict him.
Yeah. But do you think it's like a useful metric for ranking
which
is the best caliber or not?
Absolutely not.
No.
Absolutely not. No, I think the problem is that metric has been used because it's very simple. It's very accessible.
Yeah.
It's still used today, which is what I was getting at with this coming across this forum where they were talking about handgun cartridges. And that's where I first came across it. Somebody had said, according to the Taylor knockout factor, the 480 Ruger is so much better than the 454 Casull.
Yeah.
Which, again, you're talking about, you know, apples and bananas on this one. There's a lot there to unpack to try to determine something like what is more effective and in what case and using what rounds. But this guy was convinced that using this same scale, this Taylor knockout factor, the 480 ranked higher than the 454, which again, bigger diameter bullet, heavier bullet, okay. scores better.
Yeah, so he's just really biased towards big,
yeah.
big bullets.
Yeah, well, he was trying to defend the round, and that's fine. And I think the 480 is probably a pretty good round. I've never shot
it. Well, I mean, like the Taylor knockout factor is really biased towards big bullets.
It is, right? And we know that. But I think to your question about whether I think it's a legitimate means of determining which rounds are better, yeah. absolutely not, because used outside of the context in which he intended it for, even the guy who invented it came out and said, "Don't. Yeah. This is not meant to be what these guys are using it for. It's strictly to speak to this knockout idea, you know, like actually delivering a, mm-hmm. a knockout blow, mm-hmm. not a killing blow, knockout blow.
Right.
So it only really speaks to rifles, for one. So mm-hmm. applying that to handguns is a complete non-starter for me. But also, even within the confines of the rifle, he's speaking to on big game, big dangerous game, heavy bone, thick skin
yep.
animals. And like you said, because you and I and pretty much everybody else out there has never had an opportunity, at least today, living today, has had an opportunity to even go on a hunt like that, let alone enough to be able to speak to the validity of this.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a wash. I can't really dismiss it in that context.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't recommend using that as an equation that would sure. it wouldn't necessarily justify yeah. like your purchase of a new yeah. round. You yeah. know, if you wanted to find the next best round, a lot of that's just going to come from, you know, getting out in the field and yeah. trying it out.
So on that note, I know you're looking at you know, bear defense guns,
right?
So I personally have a Ruger Red Hawk Alaskan, super Red Hawk Alaskan in 454 Casull.
Yeah, which I've shot those before,
and I keep telling you, like, why don't you just get that? Then we can have the same cartridges and.
It makes sense. It makes all the sense in the world. But I, for one, the Alaskan, my big dig against the Red Hawk and the Alaskan in particular, because I like the Red Hawk platform. It's a double action Ruger, big frame, shoots, you know, big magnum rounds. My big dig on the Alaskan is that despite being very handy because it's got a very short barrel, that short barrel also means that a cartridge like the 454 doesn't burn all the powder. So not only are you're losing a lot of velocity, you're also getting a shit ton of muzzle flash and muzzle flip.
Yeah, I mean, the 450. Let's not talk about the guns. What caliber are you looking at?
I'm actually looking at the 44 mag. And I know that's a little bit light. I think, you know, we talk about facing down a grizzly bear. They're, what, 1,200 pounds of raw, angry teeth and claws and muscle and heavy bone. They are, I mean, really...
Well, that would be an exceptionally large bear, but...
A 1,200-pound bear?
Yeah.
Oh. 800 pound? Would that be a little more
accurate? That would be like, yeah, a large...
What about a Kodiak bear?
That's what we're talking about. Okay. But like, when we're like hunting elk in Montana or Idaho...
Right, you're not going to see something quite that size. Okay, so that's like a little hyperbole. Maybe not 1,200 pounds, but 800 is plenty. It's a big animal. A big animal. They move 30 miles an hour. They're faster than even Olympic sprinters. They're extremely right. powerful animals. So the idea of using any handgun as a defense mechanism for something that size is a little bit ludicrous on the face of it, because everything's inadequate. It doesn't. Yeah. I mean, it just is. Right. Even the big. If you walk out there with an X-Frame Smith & Wesson 500, it's still, you're going to be wishing you had something bigger. So already out of the gates, I see like a 44 mag as being on the lighter end. But I've shot 44 mags before. I feel like not only are the... Because you can get up to a 300 grain hard cast bullet for mm-hmm. that. And it's a potent round. It's something that the recoil is still... It's still controllable for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big part of it, is like a comfort level. Personally, a 44 mag, a hot 44 mag, is just about as much fun as I want to have. And I also want a gun that I'm going to shoot frequently, because, you know, the familiarity and accuracy is really key here. And from what I've found from shooting those 454s out of the Alaskan, is it's so punishing that I don't want to do it. You know, like, I'll do it reluctantly, but I don't want to.
Yeah.
And if I don't want to, I probably am going to skip that at the range and go for something that's just more pleasant to shoot. Right. And that's not what you want. You don't want to be unfamiliar with your gun or just not confident in it. So I don't know. I haven't figuratively pulled the trigger on purchasing a gun yet, but yep. I'm looking at Ruger Blackhawk. They just rolled out a 3-inch model. That's nice, kind of a compact a little package in a 44 mag with a Bisley grip. It's just, oh, man.
But, oh, well, that's interesting. I kind of wanted to ask you about it because I wanted to make fun of you a little bit. Because the last time I talked to you, you were like, oh, I really like that 480.
I do. I like that, too. I like the idea of the 480. The problem with the 480 Ruger, and this is no knock against Ruger, it was a dead cartridge out of the gates. They didn't have a very good release. It's always going to be relegated to like this, basically the 41 mag, which is also one of my longtime favorites. Mm-hmm. It's always going to be that middle child cartridge that it has a niche following, but it doesn't have a lot of choice when it comes to bullet weights or availability of cartridges. The brass is expensive. The round itself doesn't really do anything a whole lot better than, there's so many other ones that are out there right now. The 454 is a good example. The 500, I think it's a JRH. It's that's a unique one. Yeah. It's basically a 500 Smith & Wesson short. There aren't too many manufacturers that have guns chambered to that. There's a lot of big, kind of weird cartridges and handguns.
Yeah.
That
I
don't want something so proprietary because I want something that I can find frequently, find stuff to load for it, be able to adjust bullet weights and not have to spend a ton of money on it.
Yeah. I was just kind of trying to speak to, this kind of common attitude out there where people just, they have it in their mind what they like, and then they find all these reasons to justify why that one's the best, right?
Well, that's because, a Taylor knockout,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. But so when we were having that conversation, you were like admitting to me all these reasons why you should go with a 454, and you were like, but I just want a 480. You know, and there's just so much of that out there where people have it, they just have it in their mind that they have, there's this thing that they want and that it's bigger, so it must be better, and I'm going to come up with a reason why.
Yeah, and defend it to the death.
Exactly.
And I mean, that could be taken down the road to everything from religion to politics, yep. You name it, where you find something, it's a, you know, like a cognitive reaction where you're just biased towards something and you want other people to see it the way you do.
Yeah.
And even when it doesn't make sense. And I'm guilty of that too, man. I catch a whole lot of grief about my choice for going with like the 41 mag. Why? It's so, you have now like two bullet loads to choose from. And I had the option. It was the same cost to buy the 44 mag version or the 41. It would have been the same exact cost.
Yeah.
And I went the 41 mag because I like different stuff and it's just weird enough to pique my interest. But no, you're absolutely right. That's very common, especially when you get into the caliber debate. People find something they like and that's all there is to it. It's tough to convince them otherwise. And there's some really sketchy math and physics being thrown around when it comes to ballistics and a whole lot of experts. And I'll be the first to admit, as you know, the guy who barely passed physics in high school, I'm in no position to knock on people for not knowing enough about physics. But when there has to be some degree of self-awareness with this study in particular. This is a really complex, there's so many variables. Everything, like I said, sectional density, cavitation, you get it's a rabbit hole. You get down into the weeds on that, and it's a really complex issue.
Right.
Well, not issue, but conversation.
Yeah.
And people are always on the lookout for something to simplify it, which is, I think, where this Taylor knockout factor gets brought up and just won't die.
Yeah.
It has a very niche application that maybe has some legitimacy to it.
Yeah.
But it's being applied to a number of things it was never intended for.
Right. So mostly when people are talking about it, it's just a bunch of BS.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Confirmed. Gotcha. Can confirm.
So tell us about this most miserable hunting experience.
Oh, yeah. I thought this was fun because I think everybody has at least one that stands out in their mind. Hunting in general it's not typically a comfortable activity. Right. I mean, if you're out there working at it, you're going to be cold.
Yeah.
You're going to get wet.
It's part of the game.
It's part of the game. And
part of what we love about it. Really.
That's right. Because the suffering kind of informs the experience.
It makes it memorable.
It sure does. Special. But some are especially memorable. And usually that's in direct relation to just how miserable things actually get. And in my case, I was on a duck hunting trip in Devil's Lake, North Dakota.
Yeah.
And this was my first time out with this group of guys. And I admit I did not do my due diligence on the front end checking my gear. I thought everything was good to go. from what it was last year, it was clearly not. So I get out in the field, and we spent all day out there. I mean, we'd hop in a boat, you launch the boat, and Devil's Lake is a weird place. It's cool, but it's almost like this post-apocalyptic looking feel about it, because the lake will rise to the point where farm fields are completely covered, and you look out in the distance and see a silo, just the tip of a silo that's everything else is submerged.
Yeah.
So you could be riding in your little duck boat going over the roof of somebody's house that maybe a couple of years ago somebody was living
there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really bizarre. You'll be driving along a road and all of a sudden it just terminates into water. Like, there it is. You know there's a road under there somewhere, but you don't know how deep.
Yeah.
So it's a really unusual place in that way. But we'd go out and you launch the boat and we brought food with us. You brought your guns, your ammo, everything you need. And I turned out to have a puncture in my waders right up around, like, my thigh.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And it was a good one, too. Not just a little trickle, but, like, a full-on, I must have got snagged on barbed wire, like, the last time we went out.
So, like, 5 minutes in, your legs just
full of water already. Completely soaked. Completely soaked. And every time I'd get in the water, it wasn't like a wetsuit where at least that water that was trapped would warm up and kind of serve as an insulative layer. Oh, no. It was like flushing back through, so I had a nice stream of this nice cold water, and it had to have been probably in the mid to high 30s the whole time, just on the edge of freezing.
Yeah.
And I was so cold. I had every layer I brought. I had my hat pulled down, and I could not get warm. And I was too proud to just tell the guys, you know, I got to go back to the truck. I think I'm going to end up with hypothermia if I stay out here.
Right.
But it's amazing how miserable being cold can be. And I think a lot of that just stems from having the right gear, thinking ahead and packing a number of layers. I know we've talked about that extensively for that trip we have coming up out to Idaho in the fall. Having the right layers, you wrote a whole article about it that was really insightful. Like, you know, the mid layer, your base layer, and what it takes to keep warm in a variety of conditions, because you don't really know until you're out there just how miserable it's going to get or what kind of conditions you're going to run into.
Yep.
But I was so ill-prepared for that trip, and I got out there and spent all day wet and miserable and physically on the verge of, like, you're constantly shivering, and you're trying to enjoy it because, God, the duck hunting out there is amazing.
Yeah.
It's so good. You're driving down the freeway, and in the ditches, there's just thousands of ducks. They're just hanging out in the ditches.
Yeah.
And it was such an opportunity, and I just felt like that one in particular, I could have done my due diligence ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
And just a quick once over of my gear probably would have saved me a whole lot of grief. But that one in particular stands out as having been one of the more miserable hunting experiences I've been on.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about you? I've been looking forward to hearing this.
So I guess I kind of have two, and one was, like, one, it was short-lived, so it wasn't, like, a long-time miserable thing, but it was just a disaster. And then I have, so that was actually also a duck hunting one.
And what does that say about duck hunting?
Right.
I had a little departure here. My mom had spoken to that. She could never understand why we'd get up and go duck hunting, because generally it is really wet. It's usually pretty cold. Not so much lately, now that they've moved the season opener up quite a bit. But back in the day, you know, it was mid-October by the time we'd get out in the field and into the swamp. And, you spent a lot of time cold. But she would always joke that one of the stories she'd heard from an old coworker was that he used to duck hunt, and now he just goes and hops in the shower with his clothes on and turns the cold on all the way. And he feels like that's adequate to remind him why he doesn't go out.
Yeah. So for that one, the duck hunting one, I was pretty new to hunting still. And I went with a guy we went to high school with, Scott Engelman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
We were like, let's go duck hunting. You know, here's this place. Let's go check it out. And we hopped in a canoe. And we canoed across this lake. And it was, you know, a good-sized lake. We probably canoed a half a mile. So a decent sized lake, and we get out there, and there's these cattails, and, you know, it looks like a great little swampy slough kind of place that we can post up and hunt. You know, the water's like 6 inches of water, you know, coming up to these cattails and stuff. Great. Looks like an awesome spot. We'll post up on the edge for the morning, and then, you know, and then there's like cattails for days, and we're like, and we can go in the afternoon, we can go jump them back there, just walk back there, jump them up, whatever. So we're pulling up to buy these cattails, and like you said, you know, the water's 6 inches deep. You know, you look and you're like, you see the ground. Turns out this is a floating bog.
Oh no. I know where this is going. Yeah. It's not good.
No. So, and Ryan, and I'm like new to hunting still, pretty much. So, yep. I don't know. I'm like, looks like ground to me, right? And we hunt this slough out here.
That is like that. And that, it is solid ground.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, you hop up.
It looks exactly the same, but it's not the same. Right? So, I go to jump out of the canoe. Not like slowly testing things. I'm like, here I go, hopping out, you know, full on one leg, swinging it out, let's go. And then my leg just keeps going down, 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 down.
That's
down.
A bad feeling. And how deep was it? It's the water at that point.
It was chest deep.
Oh boy.
I mean, I full on fell out
over the waders.
Fell out, tipped the canoe.
So you brought it, Scotty, brought, too.
Dumped Scotty in the water, our guns in the water, oh, everything. No. Just a disaster.
That's a day ender right there.
100%, right? And I mean, it's like late September, mid-October, something like that. So it's like cold out. The air temperature's 40, 45 degrees, and we are soaked head to toe.
Yep, back to the truck we go.
And we got a half a mile canoe trip back across the lake.
Oh, no.
So once we like find all of our stuff and get it back into the canoe and manage to scramble back in, because we're in chest deep water.
Right.
Once we finally scramble back in, now we have a half a mile
miserable
of paddling to do.
And disappointing. Like, not just miserable.
Yeah, we're
but
so
also,
excited to get out duck hunt, and instantly it ended.
Before it even started.
Before it started.
That's disappointing.
Oh man, it was so that canoe trip, like the paddle back, was just miserable.
Oh, I,
so
I can
cold.
Imagine.
So that was the most.
I could see that
miserable,
being,
disastrous.
That's
one.
A good one.
And the other one that was like, it was kind of miserable, but it kind of wasn't. Was the first time I went bear hunting out in Idaho in the Bitterroot Mountains. I mean, it was great. It's beautiful, and I ended up having a great time like camping out there. But I was so out of shape for the mountains. Like, I thought I was in pretty good shape, right? Sure. I'm like a former collegiate athlete. You know, I played hockey in college, and, you know, I still go to the gym regularly. So I'm like, yeah.
Well, and you're just a big, burly, strong guy. I mean, you work out a lot, but you're also just like physically imposing. We'll put it that way.
Yeah. And so I'm like, yeah, I'll be good, you know? Oh my God.
Well, but there's so many aspects. As I've never been out that way, but as it's been explained to me a number of times, when you're on the mountain, there's so many other variables that come into play, and a lot of it comes down to getting your breath, right? I mean, it's not just the altitude is one thing, the ascent, you know, going up these steep mountains, carrying all the kit, because you backpacked in too, which is different.
Right,
that's a whole different animal. You're carrying what, an 80-pound pack?
Yeah.
So you start factoring in all this stuff, like, so you can't catch your breath. You're hiking straight up this. What was the elevation of the one that you talked about the last time we spoke about this? Like, what the overall elevation? You'd figured out how many, like, for every 10 steps you took, like, you went ascended a foot.
Oh yeah, it was every I think it was every 3 feet forward you went up, or I think it was every 10 feet forward you went up a full foot in elevation.
Which is just brutal if you can envision that.
Right, and that's like the switchbacks. That's not like if you went straight up the mountain. That's like when you're hiking the switchbacks. Right, so I think
if
you went straight up the mountain, it was like 3,000 feet in a quarter mile or something like
that's
that.
It's just insane. I can't even picture that. That's.
But so, you know, and there was still snow on the ground, like a lot of snow on the ground. And I was so out of shape. And I've done a lot of backpacking in the mountains before and stuff, so I'm like, oh, this will be fine, whatever. No, I was absolutely crushed.
I'm a little concerned for my sake getting into this in the fall, because it's my first time doing the backpacking thing, my first time going up a mountain.
Yeah.
I like to think I'm in good shape, but I also have the self-awareness to know that, you know, hanging out in the gym a lot and having what maybe aesthetically... being in good shape does not necessarily equate to being in the right kind of good shape. For
yeah, being able to bench press a lot of weight doesn't help you climb a mountain very well.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I was so tired. I made it I was 500 feet. So I didn't even make it close to where I had planned to camp, but there was another place where I'm like, where I knew it would be a good place to camp. So I'm like, well, I'll just stay there. And I was 500 yards away from there, but still like straight up.
Right.
Right. So I was, all I was 500 yards away, and I was so exhausted. I had to stop and take a half hour nap. Not just a break.
A nap.
Before I could
make it that drag final my butt the rest yard. Of
the 500 yards.
You could see the camp from here and you yeah, just was, can't just, make it.
I was miserably out of shape and you know, I didn't know. I thought I was still in, you know, decent shape, but I wasn't clearly. I had a lot of work to do, so.
Well, until you've done it, you know, it's.
Yeah, yep, exactly, and so.
And I'd imagine every scenario is different. Like you said, with the snow on the ground, that's a new factor that can complicate things. You know, if you're fighting every step, even with good boots, you know, if you have to put on crampons or whatever to be able to get around, it's all added weight. It complicates things.
Yep. And then on top of it, you know, so I mean, you know, the nighttime temperatures were down into the 20s and,
oh, great.
And on the last day before I headed out, it just rained the whole day.
Lovely.
So,
so you could be wet too.
Yeah.
Well, and you spoke to that a while back, how important having good rain gear is. Because once you're wet.
Essential.
If
you're going to be in the backcountry, you have to have
good
rain gear. Because, I mean, you get wet.
You just won't get warm.
Yeah. And, I mean, you could easily die.
Yep.
But.
It's not. As miserable as that long canoe trip was back. It's different when it took you a day to hike in to a place and to get back to your truck, let alone civilization.
Right, yeah, and my truck is still 60 miles away from cell phone service.
Right. Yeah. So that's not a great place to be. So having the right layers. I'm increasingly a believer in having good gear. I know that sounds kind of arrogant because not everybody can afford top-of-the-line gear,
right?
Myself included. I mean, we talked about that just before we started the show. You're looking over some of my equipment, and it's like, this is... okay.
Yeah.
This will work.
It'll work.
But it's not
ideal. You'd be happier with something else, but it'll work.
Well, and sometimes it's heavier. Sometimes it's, you know, clumsier. It doesn't work quite as efficiently.
Yep.
But you want to have good enough gear that at least it's been tested. At least you're sure that it's not going to let you down at a pivotal moment.
Yeah.
Which, and you want to test that out before you reach that critical moment.
Yeah. And it was fortunate. I mean, I had really good rain gear with me, so I stayed dry, but it was just like kind of wet and cold and miserable.
And
I was already out there for a few days, like getting my butt kicked by the mountains, and so I was
just the icing on the cake.
So, you know, it was a wake up call that I needed to really get back into shape. But which that's actually kind of a, you know, I don't know, maybe a good place for us to put a little quick plug in that.
Yeah,
you know, we're in the process of. Building up some workout programs and things like that for people who are doing different kinds of hunting with a friend of ours, the guys from TNT Outdoor Life. Tony is actually a certified personal trainer, so we're working with him to put together some material, workout plans, instructional videos, and things like that for you guys if you're interested
because it's a really vital aspect that I think gets overlooked a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm guilty of that too. I mean, a lot of the hunting that I've done growing up has been pretty tame. Like, I thought I was quite the outdoorsman, but really I was never that far away from the truck. You kind of have a lot of luxuries built in. Your deer stand's not that far away. I was young enough where it didn't really matter. You know, I didn't have to train. I bounced back from stuff in a hurry. But training is crucial. I mean, having that baseline foundation of preparation, you know, being able to physically keep up and to go into these areas and take on this terrain is really essential, because if you get into trouble, a lot of times that's what gets you out, is being able to just tough it out, make it that extra quarter mile, whatever, lift yourself out of a situation. It's you don't want to be having a heart attack, go into cardiac arrest when you're in the backwoods, and that could be, even if you're far enough away from your
even the back wheeler. 40.
Yeah, I mean,
you
really
have a heart attack in the back 40. Well, nobody's gonna see you,
right?
Man, haven't seen Nate for a couple of days.
Yeah, has anybody
Nate
checked in?
Nate didn't make it back home tonight. Has any, you know, anybody seen him?
Right. It's a
by
concern.
Then it's too late.
It's a concern, and especially for a lot of older hunters, as they get up in their age. I know a lot of these guys, they're tough as nails. They fight through pain, and it's
yep.
But that's not always it. Toughness doesn't always inform your ability to survive a situation, because a lot of it is just your body can't handle it. So training, having that foundation of that healthy living, even if you're not a gym member, even if you're not into the workout, that whole lifestyle, at least trying to prepare somewhat.
Yeah, there are things you can do without a gym membership that can still really go a long way towards preparing you. So,
and we'll explore that. Yeah. Right? I mean, this is all stuff that we'll have available. Tony's a great guy for this. I mean, he's not, like you said, not only is he a certified personal trainer, he's also a really excellent hunter too. I mean, he's put together some pretty impressive kills, and he and Tommy have really got some of those bucks, man, that they've taken down. I've got envy.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I've never even seen anything.
I mean, if you guys want to go see, check them out. It's TNT Outdoor Life. They got a YouTube channel, a Facebook page. You can check out their videos, see some of those big old bucks they've been getting after.
And they're bow hunters. I mean,
turkeys. They take turkeys with bows and stuff like that. So check them out. But then, if you want to learn more about the fitness, check us out. We've got
something up on the site already that kind of gives a little background.
And we're going to be adding more and more. So if that's something that is important to you, and I mean, it also just makes the rest of your life easier, and
it does.
Keeps you healthy. So
it does.
It's important. But check it out. Anyway.
Absolutely.
Enough of a plug.
Is it dipe time?
Yeah.
Dipe time. we need to keep kicking around ideas for the name. But this time around, the dumb idea poorly executed is the elk behavioral study conducted by the Idaho Fish and Game.
Yeah, behavioral modification study.
Right. So they're going to, you're going to have to give me a little background on this, because I have a vague idea of what they're trying to accomplish. But the basis, as I understood it, was that this is something that they were trying to, it's a research.
Yeah. Effort. So it's a research study by a graduate student at the University of Idaho, trying to figure out how to change elk behavior to reduce depredation by elk. So elk are going into farmers' fields, eating their crops, trampling it down, just, they're causing damage to these crops. And it's expensive, because then Fish and Game has to go compensate these farmers. And so Fish and Game would love to know a way to help mitigate that, reduce the amount of depredation that's going on. So this graduate student, in conjunction with Idaho Fish and Game, they're doing this depredation or elk behavioral modification study to try and reduce the amount of depredation that's going on by elk. So there were four things that they were trying out that they're studying to see which one works the best. There's putting up specialized fencing to try and keep elk out of fields. There's having trained dogs to chase them off. And there's trying to put like a chemical application on that tastes bad to elk so that they don't want to eat it. And then there's just having at them and
taking them out.
Yeah, just killing them out.
Oh, okay. But I foresee some issues here. But that one, that aspect of the study in particular, they killed, what was it, 200?
It was a little over 200. I believe it was 203 elk out of the Magic Valley area and a couple of surrounding units.
Okay.
And it was in 1 year.
And these were just, it was just a straight up, just removing these elk.
They had basically Idaho Fish and Game employees posted up killing these elk when they come into the fields.
That seems, all right, explain to me how that was supposed to have informed, because if you've killed them, then that takes them out of the population. Doesn't that distort then the results of the rest of the study?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And is that really even a viable... And if that had... If you're going to take that approach, this takes us back to our last podcast, why wouldn't you have just increased the number of tags available in that?
Yeah. Now, so here's what Idaho Fish and Game claims, that they couldn't have hunters do this because these elk had... they had changed their behavior to come out at night.
Why would they have changed their behavior to come out at night?
Because,
I mean,
there's pressure on them during the day. There is a depredation tag available. So like once once it becomes an issue for a farmer that the elk are coming and damaging their crops, they can then apply. They can go to the fishing game and apply for tags to then kill these elk at that point.
Okay.
Once they've already
caused the damage, right? Right.
And there are, hunters can get in on this and things like that. But hunters can only shoot those elk during daylight hours.
Okay.
Right? The general public can't shoot elk after dark.
Okay.
Overnight for safety concerns.
Sure.
Right.
So then were these sharpshooters shooting them at night?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
This is what Idaho Fish and Game is saying is the rationale for why they had to have fish and game employees, sharpshooters, and not just the general public with hunting tags.
Okay.
I
get the sense that that's not... Well, what's your take on that, though? Because that doesn't seem like that's a legitimate... I mean, if... Why would they have changed their... When did the study take place? Do we know?
It was this past summer.
Oh, okay. So, but then it was outside of...
It was outside of hunting season.
So
it was outside of the general hunting season.
Okay, so then how could you make the argument that they're being pressured during the day? What are they being pressured by?
Well, again, you can get these depredation tags, and those aren't just during the hunting season.
Okay. So that's any time of year that the landowner could apply for...
Correct.
Okay.
These elk are damaging our crops. We need to remove these
elk. But I would imagine that would only... those tags would only apply to the landowner's property, correct?
Correct.
Right. So is that going to apply that pressure? It just seems like it's a little bit of a tenuous excuse.
Yeah, it does. I think where the genesis of this comes from is the idea that animals that are under a predation threat change their behavior.
But aren't elk always arguably under a predation threat? I mean, you look at their natural predators. They're obviously the fall when there's an actual rifle hunting season. That's going to change. There's a lot more pressure then.
Yep.
That I understand.
Yep.
But over the entire course of the year, these animals do exist in their own environment in which there's other predators that pursue these elk.
Yeah.
And they don't change. That is part of their natural cycle. So it's not like they're going to change their... If they've changed their behavior, they did it eons ago.
Right.
But I don't... There's something here that doesn't seem to track.
Yeah.
Crucially, what does shooting 200 of these elk really inform about the study? What effect does that have on the study?
Yeah. So the hypothesis that they're testing, really... I mean, it is a study, so they're testing hypothesis is... Well, if every time these elk come into this field, some of them get shot, eventually they'll stop coming into this field, right? Is the hypothesis.
Okay.
Right. But there may be some validity to that, but how do you compare that, right? So the study is comparing which of these is the best thing.
Right.
Well, but now you're comparing results where animals have actually been removed from the population versus ones where animals haven't been removed. So there are now fewer animals to come back and cause this problem.
So is that...
And so that's going to skew the results.
Right.
Has it actually changed their behavior? Or is there just fewer animals on the landscape now? Which is the reason there's less depredation.
Right.
Right? So it's not useful in determining, are we changing their behavior... Yes, there's less depredation.
Or are we just removing enough of them that
exactly.
we get the results we were looking
exactly.
for?
Exactly. And so
and their behavior hasn't really changed.
Yeah, so they can't really speak to whether the behavior has changed or whether there's just fewer animals on the landscape, effectively, at least in my opinion.
Right. Well, it seems that would...
Comparatively to the ones where no animals were...
Right, it distorts... Yeah, absolutely. No, that's... At least that was my take on it when I first read about it. It just seemed like... That doesn't seem like the best way to go about that.
Was the goal. The other thing I had, my other kind of beef with it is, why do they go straight to a lethal force action with these sharpshooters, right?
Sure.
So like up in Canada, Parks Canada, for years, decades now, they have used things like firecrackers and rubber bullets to keep bears away from roadways.
Okay.
Because, I mean, there are all sorts of reasons why they want to keep bears away from roadways. Right? Bears can get hit by cars, and they certainly don't want these, you know, the bears to get killed by a car.
Gawker blocks.
You get exactly. There's a bear off in the distance, and 1,000 people stop their car, get out, and they're taking pictures. You get people walking up trying to get close to the bears, and then people get mauled. It's just, you know, it can be a bad situation.
For everybody.
For everybody.
Yeah.
So they, you know, try and keep these bears a certain distance away from roads. And when they come to the roads, they're firing off firecrackers. They're shotgun blasts into the air. Even rubber bullets. You know, to habituate them to stay away from this area.
Right.
Right. And now you're actually taking that individual bear is learning to not come back. Because there's an adverse thing that has happened to it.
Right.
Versus here.
It's happening to
killed
the herd.
Another animal.
Right.
You know, it's not keeping, it's hard to say how much
the other animals,
elk learns from another elk being killed.
Right.
And so I think a more useful thing would have been to study, you know, aggressive but non-lethal interaction with these elk to change their behavior. Plus, then you're also not removing animals from the population, changing the number of animals.
Preserving the integrity of the study that
exactly,
way.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Anyway, that's my opinion on it. And a lot of people seem to agree, but we're not the ones who make the decisions. So.
No, we're not. Nobody consulted us, Carl. I never got the call. Well, buddy, I think that's a wrap on this one. This has been a fun conversation. Let's do it again.
Absolutely.
All right, folks, we'll catch up with you soon. Thanks for tuning in.